Zhang's control of Shanghai was made possible with the aid of two main groups. Wealthy merchants and foreign capitalists supported the KMT with the understanding that there would be no reforms that threatened their interests. And Shanghai's major criminal groups strengthened their own hold on official power by enabling Zhang to destroy the city's Communist Party and labor movement in 1927. These Shanghai criminal organizations were dominated by two secret society groups called the Green and Red Circles, or gangs. Secret societies, whether political, social, or criminal, were traditionally an important force in Chinese society whenever central authority broke down. During the 19th century, the Red and Green gangs had drawn their membership from people involved in transporting grain and smuggling salt along the Grand Canal, China's primary north-south inland waterway. After 1911, these groups shifted their activities to the cities of central China, particularly to Shanghai. Shanghai had been an important Chinese center for the opium traffic since the 1840s, when Britain's victory in the Opium War opened the port to foreign trade and the establishment of foreign-controlled areas, or concessions, which by the 1930s included almost a third of the city's 3.5 million people. The city's tradition of involvement in opium and other vices that tended to accompany the Western presence in Asia was tailor-made for the Green and Red gangs. Both evolved into criminal organizations whose role in the narcotics trade and in the anti-communist movement suggest parallels with the roles of the Sicilian Mafia and Corsican syndicate groups in Europe. One of Shanghai's most influential citizens was Tu Yuesheng, narcotics overlord, anti-Japanese patriot, and leader of the Green Gang, who began his career in Shanghai's French settlement, a noted center of illicit activities where criminals were permitted to operate freely.
Nip, we may want to spell some of these complicated Chinese names for people, because I know that probably, if I was listening, I wouldn't necessarily know, be able to anticipate how that was spelled.
Good point. The one we're talking about now, of course, the narcotics overlord and head of the Green Gang is Tu. That's the last name. In Chinese, of course, it's put first. T-U, Tu. And then his first name is Yuesheng, Yueh-sheng. Tu Yuesheng, narcotics overlord, anti-Japanese patriot, and leader of the Green Gang, who began his career in Shanghai's French settlement, a noted center of illicit activities where criminals were permitted to operate freely. In exchange for tax profits on vice, the French turned the administration of the settlement over to the gangs. Tu became the protege of a man known as Pockmarked Huang, H-U-A-N-G, who was the chief of detectives in the French concession and a major Green Gang leader. In addition to owning several opium dens, Huang served an important function as intermediary in negotiations and disputes between various groups in the foreign-controlled and Chinese settlements. Prior to 1918, Shanghai's opium traffic was based in the British concession, under the control of Chinese from the Swatow area of Kwantung province. In 1918, the British concession cracked down on opium, depriving the Swatow group of its base and opening the traffic to takeover by the Green Gang, operating from the French concession. During the 1920s, Tu Yuesheng unified the competing gangster organizations involved in the drug traffic and extended his influence from the French settlement out to the more prosperous international settlement. Tu became one of the, quote, Big Three among the Shanghai gangsters, working with Pockmarked Huang and Chang Xiaolin, spelled C-H-A-N-G, and then the other name H-S-I-A-O-L-I-N. This unholy triumvirate controlled the city's underworld in early 1927, when Zhang's northern expedition forces approached. Now, this is Chiang Kai-shek they're talking about. When Zhang's northern expedition forces approached. In late February 1927, labor unions allied with the KMT, again, Zhang's political party, moved against warlord control and foreign economic domination and began a general strike, planning to welcome Zhang's armies to a liberated Shanghai. For his part, Chiang Kai-shek was actively courting the support of wealthy conservative and foreign businessmen. A strong united labor movement was a major impediment. Consequently, in late February, Zhang's forces delayed their advance toward the city, hoping that reprisals by the British-run International Settlement Police and the Chinese garrison commander would break the strike and destroy its leadership. Despite bloody reprisals, labor organizers ordered a second strike to begin March 21st, a massive display of workers' power that shut down the city once again in anticipation of the KMT's victorious advance. Although there was disturbing evidence that Jiang was beginning to conduct a violent purge of communists and suspected communists in the cities under his control, the communist leadership, with the encouragement of Comintern advisors, doggedly continued to support the alliance and, with increasing difficulty, ignored the ominous signs of KMT treachery. The strike caused considerable consternation in the Chinese and foreign business communities, and Jiang set about persuading these interests to support him, simultaneously avoiding a public declaration of outright hostility toward the communists. On arriving in Shanghai in late March, he met first with pockmarked Wang, and later with leading Chinese industrialists and bankers who became satisfied that under Jiang's control there would be no further trouble from organized labor. The gratified businessmen then presented him with a, quote, loan of 3 million Shanghai dollars, the first of a series of lucrative donations. Okay, so what we're seeing here, as we mentioned at the beginning, is Chiang Kai-shek taking originally a nationalist movement. In this case, the Kuomintang Party, originally a nationalist and progressive movement interested in unifying the government of China, and not only taking it over, but then beginning a purge of the communists and actually betraying the nationalist supporters in the city who are performing a labor strike against foreign economic domination. Instead, Chiang Kai-shek has already decided that foreign domination is what he's interested in, and sits outside the city, much in the same way that the Americans refused to drop arms to the communist resistance in northern Italy. Chiang Kai-shek decides to wait outside the city to see if the British and the Chinese garrison soldiers wipe out the strikers, who, again, remember, are people who are supposed to be his allies. But the fact that they are labor, the fact that they are progressive, and the fact that Chiang Kai-shek was even at that point moving to the extreme right meant that they were no longer useful to him. So Chiang Kai-shek comes into Shanghai after allowing the strike to be severely stomped on, and immediately begins to court the local gangsters in the person of pockmarked Wang, who had already been a part of the power structure, and also the local businessmen, who then give him $3 million. So Chiang Kai-shek is now riding tall in the saddle in Shanghai and beginning to thoroughly purge any leftist or moderate elements out of his nationalist party.
And broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills. Now, returning again to China from here in the South Bay, California, the main ally that Chiang Kai-shek enlisted in order to break the working class of Shanghai was none other than Tu Yuesheng, one of the big three, unquote, of Shanghai gangsters, and for our purposes here, perhaps most noteworthy, the man who at this point dominates the opium traffic in Shanghai. Returning to the politics of heroin in Southeast Asia. Chiang had some 3,000 troops under his command in the city, pitted against a larger but poorly armed force of workers and communists. He doubted whether his soldiers could be trusted to turn against the workers' groups, which they considered their main allies, and turned to Tu Yuesheng and his colleagues for help. It is widely believed that Chiang in his youth had become a fully initiated member of Shanghai's Green Gang. Regardless of whether this is the case, Chiang and the Green Gang shared a common interest in destroying Shanghai's labor movement. By serving Chiang, the gangs could and did increase their influence and wealth. At Chiang's behest, Tu organized a moderate labor group, the Common Advancement Association, which recruited and armed thousands of gangsters throughout the city. The communists and other labor leaders, pathetically, tragically, determined to maintain the charade of alliance with the KMT, were taken by surprise and massacred, many of them by Tu's gangsters, beginning April 12, 1927, and continuing sporadically for months. As a result of this coup, Shanghai's gang leaders grew even more powerful. In appreciation for their services and their deliberate and anticipated performance as intermediaries between Chiang and the foreign community, the big three were appointed as honorary advisors, unquote, to the nationalist government. Furthermore, Tu Yuesheng was made a major general at Chiang's headquarters in addition to serving as a municipal official and as an employee of the American-owned Shanghai Power Company. As the purge continued, after 1927, the gangsters, with Kuomintang and foreign support, thoroughly infiltrated Shanghai's labor movement in order to prevent a recurrence of the pre-1927 threat, unquote, from organized labor. In September of 1931, for example, one non-communist labor organizer who had led a tramway strike in the French settlement was denounced, arrested, and sentenced to 10 years imprisonment after a trial that lasted 10 minutes. Chiang Kai-shek's opium programs further illustrate the gap between the Kuomintang's original political idealism and the sordid reality of conditions under his dictatorship. Like the warlords, Chiang needed money to finance his military campaigns, and in August of 1927, the nationalists legalized the opium trade, setting up a monopoly to tax opium sales. Before public pressure forced the scheme's abolition in July of 1928, the government had made an estimated 40 million Chinese dollars. Unofficial government sponsorship of the opium trade continued, and Tu Yuesheng was a central figure until 1931, when he reportedly cured his own addiction and dropped out of gambling and the drug traffic, leaving its operation to other members of the Green Gang. To compensate for Tu's financial loss, one of his close friends was given control of the newly formed state lottery, while Tu devoted his full attention to suppressing Shanghai's labor movement. The most well-publicized nationalist campaign against opium was begun in 1934. Chiang was beginning a new life movement, unquote, which derived from the Confucian belief that individual reform is the key to curing the ills of society. The programs of the new life movement, outmoded and hopelessly inadequate, never began to solve China's pressing social problems. But its idealism and Chiang's own professed Christianity were incompatible with the drug traffic. A national opium suppression bureau was organized, whose regulations involved penalties of life imprisonment or death for pushers. Although improving social welfare was the stated aim of this anti-opium campaign, its major objective was to gain control of the financial base of Chiang's warlord opponents. The Kuomintang leader appointed himself commissioner for opium suppression in 1935. By 1936, he had succeeded in rerouting opium moving toward the coast from Yunnan and Quechua so that it was sent north through Hangzhou on the Yangtze River and then to Shanghai, thus depriving Guangxi province of its opium revenue. Opium production was reduced, but the government generally hoarded seized opium instead of destroying it. According to one source, during the period 1934-7, the government made an estimated 500 million Chinese dollars from its suppression program. Japan mounted a full-scale invasion of China in 1937, driving the Kuomintang government into the interior. Although the war in the Pacific halted the flow of heroin from China to the United States after 1941, the drug traffic from China continued. During the war, the Kuomintang and the Japanese freely traded a variety of goods, including opium, across mostly stagnant battle lines. Japan played an official role in the narcotics business in occupied China. In Manchuria, the Japanese authorities used opium as a revenue source. In 1938, its sale accounted for 28% of general budget receipts. Nanking, under Japanese occupation, had an estimated 50,000 heroin addicts, and in Shanghai, about one-sixth of the $1.5 million spent every month on drugs was used to buy heroin. The Japanese invasion separated Chiang Kai-shek from his main source of financial support, but his government had a store of Sichuanese opium that had been confiscated during the suppression drive. Tu Yuesheng took charge of shipping the seized opium to the coast, and eventually it was sold at Macau and Hong Kong, both then under Japanese control. Some of the same stock was finally sold by Shanghai's official monopoly, which operated under Japanese protection. After Japan's defeat in 1945, Chiang's forces made a speedy return to Shanghai, acting with the support of the American government and the cooperation of the defeated Japanese in order to reaffirm Kuomintang control and forestall the communists. Once again, corruption and vice, including narcotics, flourished with the participation of China's nationalist officials. So let's take a look at what we've looked at here so far. We've taken a look, first of all, at how Tu Yuesheng, a Shanghai gangster, came to monopolize the opium trade in Shanghai. We then took a look at how his aide was enlisted by Chiang Kai-shek, and the Green Gang, Tu Yuesheng's criminal syndicate, was then used as a sort of, again, an anti-communist cadre by the Kuomintang in order to put down the Chinese workers in Shanghai. And it's worth noting also that even after Tu Yuesheng himself got out of the opium traffic, he delegated the control of the opium trade to other members of the Green Gang. And at this point, the Green Gang under Tu Yuesheng is basically functioning as an agent or as an arm of the Kuomintang National Security Establishment. It's also worth noting here, and this is a pattern we're going to be looking at much later in the series, and it's unfortunately a very common pattern of the very governments that are professing to control the opium trade, in fact, use the drug-controlled apparatus to maintain control of that traffic and to manipulate it for political ends. In this case, we've seen Chiang Kai-shek denying his warlord opponents the revenue from the opium trade, at the same time as that very opium trade is used to provide revenues for his own organization, and including, again, the Green Gang under Tu Yue-sheng. Now, this Green Gang is very, very important because the Green Gang, like a lot of other criminal syndicates we've looked at, eventually came to work for U.S. intelligence.
I'm going to read a very short segment now, but we'll be reading more later on, from a wonderful book called The Great Heroin Coup, which we've used quite a bit on our broadcasts.
We'll be using this book a lot in other broadcasts in this series.
Indeed. It's a wonderful work. We were just talking to one of the KFJC people here tonight about it. Also a book that is not currently in print, I don't believe, but one that if you can track it down in a library, or if you especially find a used copy somewhere, or you want to contact perhaps Tom Davis or somebody like that for a copy, it would be more than worth your time to do it. The book is, again, titled The Great Heroin Coup, Drugs, Intelligence, and International Fascism. Copyright 1980, the author Heinrich Krüger. And the book was originally published by South End Press in Boston. Okay.
Well, by the way, we're going to be reading here. The book has an excellent foreword by Peter Dale Scott, one of the top political researchers in this country and a professor at the University of California at Berkeley. He wrote an excellent foreword to this book, and it's from this foreword that we're going to be quoting right now.
Indeed. Okay, small segment here. The U.S. government's narcotics-mafia connection goes back, as is well known, to World War II. Two controversial joint operations between OSS, Office of Strategic Services, and ONI, U.S. Naval Intelligence, established contacts, via Lucky Luciano, with the Sicilian Mafia, and, via Tai Li, who we will be talking about more on the broadcast, with the dope-dealing Green Gang of Tu Yue-sheng in Shanghai. Both connections were extended into the post-war period as the Luciano and KMT network slowly resumed their pre-war contacts. So what we're going to be looking at now, as is mentioned briefly in Peter Dale Scott's foreword, is not only the fact of Chiang Kai-shek and his collusion with Tu Yue-sheng's Shanghai dope syndicate, the Green Gang, but in fact the direct connections of the U.S. government through Chiang Kai-shek and through Tai Li, who we're going to be talking about during the broadcast, right into that same milieu in just the same way that we became involved in heroin traffic in Sicily and in Marseille.
Although it should be noted that the involvement of U.S. intelligence with the narcotics traffic in the cases of Sicily and Marseille, and so far also in China, is indirect. In other words, the support given to these organized crime syndicates enabled them to become prime players, because later on we're going to be dealing with U.S. intelligence involvement directly
traffic. Well said. To this point, it's a purely political maneuver on the part of the American intelligence and military establishments, but as we shall see, it's very hard to plant those kinds of seeds without reaping the kinds of plants that grow out of them.
Indeed, and those plants have indeed been reaped. And again, at this point, the political influence creates the political circumstances leading to the resurgence of, with a vengeance, of the international heroin traffic, and eventually we'll look at direct U.S. participation, direct participation of U.S. intelligence services in that traffic. Now remember, the Green Gang under Tu Yue-sheng are being used as, in essence, a branch of the Kuomintang National Security Establishment, an anti-communist cadre, in much the same fashion as the OSS and CIA used the Sicilian Mafia and Union Chorus in the examples we looked at earlier. Once again, U.S. intelligence was to form an alliance with the Green Gang, this time through a fellow named Tai Li, who was over Tu Yue-sheng in the Kuomintang National Security Establishment. We're going to be reading now about the alliance between the Green Gang, Tai Li, Tu Yue-sheng, and U.S. intelligence from a book called OSS, subtitled A Secret History of America's First Central Intelligence Agency, authored by R. Harris Smith, and it was published in hardcover by the University of California Press, Berkeley, 1972. So, again, R. Harris Smith, OSS, about the alliance between U.S. intelligence, Tai Li, Tu Yue-sheng, and the Green Gang. Algan Lucy, L-U-S-E-Y, a former United Press correspondent in Shanghai, was a second Donovan agent at the Chinese capital. Interrupting, William Donovan was the head of OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, America's Wartime Intelligence Service. Beginning again, Algan Lucy, a former United Press correspondent in Shanghai, was a second Donovan agent at the Chinese capital. He had first been hired as a propaganda specialist by the Sherwood branch of COL, Lucy had little contact with Gale, having been assured by, quote, some very influential and powerful Chinese, unquote, that the professor was not in the best of repute, unquote. Beside hatching a futile plot to smuggle submachine guns to the Formosan independence movement, unquote, Lucy devoted his energies to cultivating the friendship of Captain Milton Mary Miles, M-I-L-E-S, a naval officer who flew to China in May of 1942 with vague orders to find out what is going on out there, unquote, and to do whatever you can to help the Navy and to heckle the Japanese, unquote. What most interested Lucy was that Miles, an experienced veteran of the U.S. Asiatic Squadron, had developed close ties to a mysterious Chinese general named Tai Li, that's T-A-I, and then L-I. Operating under the innocuous title of Director, Bureau of Investigation and Statistics, unquote, Tai Li was actually the chief of a combined secret police and intelligence organization said to control over 300,000 agents throughout China and in every foreign nation where Chinese communities existed, from Bangkok to Saigon to San Francisco. The short, stocky Chinese was a shadowy figure who had achieved legendary stature. There were whispered tales of his miraculous escapes from countless Japanese assassination attempts. It was rumored that he had acquired great wealth throughout his control of the opium trade, that he supervised concentration camps for critics of the Chiang government, that he had no qualms about ensuring thought control through political executions. General Tai, according to one OSS report, was, quote, not the Admiral Canaris of China, but the Heinrich Himmler. Interrupting to place that reference, Admiral Canaris was the head of the Abwehr, German military intelligence during World War II, and of course Heinrich Himmler was the head of the SS. And again, one OSS report compared him, said that he was more like Himmler, than Admiral Canaris, more like a repressive terror chief and butcher than a true espionage master. Continuing. Tai Li was also the, quote, completely trusted subordinate and guardian of the Generalissimo, subject only to the Generalissimo's orders, unquote. His loyalty to Chiang was a unique trait among the merry nest of gangsters, General Stilwell's term, who comprised the Kuomintang administration. Their friendship went back to the 1920s when Tai Li had joined the Chinese Communist Party to spy for Chiang, his military mentor. The Generalissimo then turned against his communist allies, and Tai Li was assigned the task of persecuting his former comrades. The general acquired the services of an underworld group of Shanghai hoodlums, the Green Gang, who specialized in kidnapping and extortion, and gave them official respectability as the foundation for his secret police organization. General Tai also had a long-standing reputation as a xenophobe who rarely met with foreigners. That was why Captain Miles' friendship with the enigmatic general was of such great interest to Lucy. With the agreement of Chiang Kai-shek, Tai Li had already suggested to Miles that they cooperate in a Sino-American friendship plan for the training of thousands of Chinese guerrillas and espionage agents. Miles had at first been suspicious of Tai Li. When he learned that General Tai's men had developed poisons in the form of Bayer aspirin tablets and Carter's little liver pills, he rushed home to collect all his household medicines and locked them away in a four-combination safe. But his wariness faded, and he soon refused to believe that Tai Li was, quote, the head of a Chinese OGPU with which anyone from the United States would be embarrassed to associate, unquote. Without consulting Washington, Miles agreed to the friendship plan. Lucy had mixed feelings about the project. He informed Washington that Tai Li's organization was, quote, very efficient and we can use it to great advantage. It is also considered utterly ruthless, and the inner circle impresses me as being a bunch of cutthroats, unquote. Nevertheless, to keep in Miles' good graces, Lucy asked OSS headquarters to help procure a shipment of short-barreled shotguns for the use of Tai Li's, quote, swell bunch of hard-hitting, honest men, good gunmen in the occupied territories, unquote. So before Nip continues with the saga of Tai Li and the OSS, let's review very briefly. Of course, we've looked already at Tu Yue Sheng, Shanghai organized crime leader, head of the Green Gang, and in that capacity, it has a monopoly over the Shanghai opium traffic. Chiang Kai-shek's government itself becomes sort of the official guarantor of the opium traffic, controlling it in political ways in order to deny the warlords opium revenue while guaranteeing his own Kuomintang organization that very same revenue. The Green Gang is then used by Chiang Kai-shek to suppress workers' strikes in Shanghai, it then becomes an official wing of the Kuomintang military and intelligence apparatus, and Tu Yuesheng himself becomes a general under Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang Kai-shek's intelligence chief, Tai Li, uses the Green Gang as the foundation for his organization throughout China. So we've got Tai Li over Tu Yuesheng and the Green Gang using this criminal syndicate as an inextricable part of his own intelligence system, and now we've seen Tai Li working with Officer Miles of U.S. Naval Intelligence, and this relationship between Tai Li, Tu Yuesheng, the Green Gang, and U.S. intelligence is to be cemented.
Now, Chiang Kai-shek, of course, because of the fact that Tai Li was one of the few people of his gang of merry bandits or whatever it was that was Stillwell's term, one of the few people that he trusted, thought it was a great idea that the OSS should make their connections with his intelligence service in the person of Tai Li. So Chiang Kai-shek pressed for the acceptance of this quote-unquote friendship plan to connect the two services, and Washington, which had very little other ways to get a lot of the intelligence information that they wanted in Asia, reluctantly went along with it. Reading again from OSS by R. Harris Smith, after several months of negotiations, and with Roosevelt's verbal approval, Donovan and Secretary of the Navy Knox put their signatures, Donovan again, of course, is William Donovan of the OSS. Donovan and Secretary of the Navy Knox put their signatures to a secret technical agreement with the Chinese government. This pact created a joint secret service, the Sino-American Cooperative Organization, SACO, under the directorship of Tai Li. Miles was deputy director, as well as Far Eastern Chief of OSS and Commander of Navy Group China. SACO was to engage in guerrilla training, espionage, sabotage, and radio interception. The Chinese agreed to supply manpower and facilities, while arms and equipment would come from the United States. It should just briefly be mentioned, to those of you who are not familiar, one of the great curses of General Stilwell. General Stilwell was probably one of the greatest generals in the history of the United States, and a man who, because of the political situation that he got stuck into, which was the maelstrom that was World War II China, has never received proper credit for his acumen. But one of the things that was going on during World War II, and it's important to realize here, is that Chiang Kai-shek had absolutely no intention whatsoever to fight the Japanese. In the northern provinces of China, of course, again, as was true in France and in Italy, the communists were the ones who were actively fighting the Japanese. Now, the Japanese occupation of China had been particularly repressive, even by Japanese standards, and it had been going on since for 2 years before the war in Europe had even started. Chiang Kai-shek, however, was so terrified, he was so terrified of the communist opposition, which had a lot of support among the people of the country, whereas Chiang Kai-shek had support only of the military, the foreign bankers, etc., etc. He was so frightened that he would rather do anything than actually waste any of his own weapons or resources fighting the Japanese. What he did for all of World War II was to stand around and tell the United States, essentially, to keep sending him money so he could fight the Japanese and use that to stockpile weapons against the communists, while the communists in the north were fighting the Japanese with hoes and shovels and rifles. Now, because of this fact, the entire Chiang Kai-shek government was geared to one concept only, and that was to make a pile of money, to outlast the war, and then, with U.S. help, consolidate themselves. But there was always the possibility that the government would fall through, so again, the first priority, making money, became very important. And the drain of U.S. funds and others from the treasuries of the Kuomintang were phenomenal. Hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars sucked out of the Lend-Lease East agreements and going directly into the pockets of Chinese officials. So this is one of the things that was going on with Tai Li and Chiang Kai-shek. These people were not leaders of a government in the common sense. These were people who had a golden goose and they were going to wring every last egg out of it while they had the opportunity before the people in China rose up en masse, which they did, and threw them out on their ear.
Now, because of the fact that General Stilwell wanted Chiang Kai-shek to fight the Japanese, he was at odds with Chiang Kai-shek, whom he couldn't stand, and the feeling was mutual. Eventually, General Stilwell was replaced by someone whose political sympathies were much, much more closely in tune with those of Chiang Kai-shek, and that's a fellow we've looked at in the past, namely General Albert Cody Wiedemeyer. Wiedemeyer's education, his military education, could be accurately described as Nazi, inasmuch as he was a graduate of the Kriegswehr Academy, the German West Point, in essence. We looked at him at considerable length in Radio Free America show number 11. Also, we touched back on General Wiedemeyer in Radio Free America number 14. But Wiedemeyer himself had an extraordinary number of fascist connections. He rented his apartment from Gerhard Rossbach, a leader of the stormtroopers who later went to work for the CIA. He was a close friend of Ludwig Beck, chief of the German General Staff. And in fact, in his own biography, his own autobiography, Wiedemeyer reports, Wiedemeyer comments that he was even known around the Kriegswehr Academy for being an enthusiastic Sieg Heiler. So we've looked at Wiedemeyer at great length, again, in Radio Free America show number 14, including his probable participation in the assassination, well, actually his definite participation in the assassination of President Kennedy, according to the SEDICI, the French Military Intelligence Service. Eventually, Wiedemeyer, again, much more closely in tune with the dyed-in-the-wool anti-communist sentiments of Chiang Kai-shek, replaces General Stilwell. It's worth noting that that when Wiedemeyer becomes American commander in China and advisor to Chiang Kai-shek, Wiedemeyer centralized all intelligence operations in China under his command. However, one of the stipulations was to be that all covert activities had to be cleared by both the American Army and the Chinese government. And as we're about to see, that placed Tai Li, through one of his closest aides, in a position to veto any intelligence operation that he disagreed with. Now, this is significant because one of the interesting aspects of Tai Li and the whole Kuomintang axis was that at times they would actually collaborate with the Japanese against the Chinese. And OSS eventually wound up at severe loggerheads with the Tai Li organization, even though they technically formed an alliance with them, because of the fact that Tai Li would not permit OSS to function in connection with the Chinese communists. Now, the Chinese communists were the most effective fighting force against the Japanese in China. As such, OSS wanted to give them the necessary logistical support to do the job and basically save American lives by pinning down and killing Japanese troops. This was totally opposed by Chiang Kai-shek, and in fact, the OSS was convinced that Tai Li's organization was murdering their own Chinese agents who attempted to effect liaison with the communists, although they weren't able to prove this. The British actually came much closer to proving that, and the British actually sent agents into China to spy on Tai Li, who they felt had German sympathies. Incidentally, one of the things we also looked at in Radio Free America show number 11 was the fact that after Tai Li was killed in a plane crash, the head of Chiang Kai-shek's military intelligence was headed up by, the head of that became a man named Louis Siefkin, who formerly was a Nazi spy who'd helped transmit intelligence on Pearl Harbor to the Japanese, facilitating their attack on Pearl Harbor. At any rate, though, it's worth noting that after General Wiedemeyer, and a background on him again in Radio Free America number 11, after Wiedemeyer assumes control of the American military situation in China, he cements American military intelligence operations to the organization of Tai Li. In other words, the Tai Li organization now has veto power over any intelligence operation in the area.
And one last thing, just to remind you, the foundation of the Tai Li organization is the heroin-dealing Green Gang.
Right. Again, Tai Li is the person over Tu Yuesheng and the Green Gang, although the Green Gang represents the core of Tai Li's organization. Continuing now from OSS by R. Harris Smith. But Wiedemeyer had a further proviso for clandestine operations. He centralized all planning for secret services at his headquarters and insisted that future covert activities be cleared, unquote, by both the American Army and the Chinese government. To represent the Generalissimo in the clearance machinery, the Chinese government appointed a general who was actually one of Tai Li's closest aides. OSS thus met with official Chinese objections whenever an operation requiring communist cooperation was proposed. In February of 1945, a contingent of Jedburghs, by the way, those were commandos who'd worked behind the lines in Europe, a contingent of Jedburghs was flown to China for commando operations. Upon their departure from the United States, they were told that they would be working with communist guerrillas, as many of them had done in France. But the Jeds never reached North China. Neither did an OSS team organized to direct and actually operate an entire military communications network for the communists. The unit, commanded by Frank Farrell, a New York newspaper editor in Marine uniform, waited impatiently at OSS headquarters in Kunming throughout the spring of 1945. The central government refused to sanction the mission. Tai Li and Miles continued to charge that OSS was collaborating with Yinan. Interrupting, Yinan was the communist Chinese capital during World War II. In July, Miles claimed that OSS had dropped submachine guns to communist plainclothesmen, unquote, at Shanghai. The point here now is that the Tai Li organization is bound even more closely to the American commitment in China, even though that commitment was actually, in as far as its effectiveness against the Japanese was concerned, was compromised by this very alliance. Even General Wiedemeyer himself, and his political sympathies could accurately be described as fascist, General Wiedemeyer himself spoke very highly, although he was militantly anti-communist, in his own writings he spoke very highly of the military performance of the Chinese communists, and while the war was still going on, did what he could to try and work with those Chinese communists. But Tai Li himself and his organization would not permit this. So it's worth noting here that this alliance actually cost American lives, because the Japanese, even until quite late in the war, enjoyed good military success in China simply due to the fact that the Kuomintang was not interested in fighting the Japanese. A lot of Americans lost their lives as a result of that.
Going to read one last short segment, and then we're going to take a break and give you a chance to get up and stretch a little bit. This is from The Great Heroin Coup, again by Henry Krueger. And he's writing again in sort of a more an overview of what some of the results of these things were. Again, he's talking about 1948 at this point. Meanwhile, in the United States, KMT agents helped establish a powerful China lobby and collaborated with friends and U.S. agencies to target, and in some cases drive from the government, old foes of the former U.S. KMT Tai Li alliance, including those inside the OSS. Before I finish this segment, let me just mention real quickly, you hear the China lobby a lot. The China lobby was a group composed of a variety of mostly right-wing Americans and Chinese. The Chinese, most of them directly out of the Chiang Kai-shek government. The leader of the China lobby was in many ways, well, besides Henry Luce of Time magazine, also General Claire Chennault, a very close friend of the Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek. And it was the China lobby, in fact, and the accusations of the China lobby that people in the State Department had given China away to the communists, an accusation that any reasonable historian would laugh at, because the Chiang Kai-shek government was so far from being an actual government, it was laughable. But it was those accusations by the China lobby against various members of the State Department and the Foreign Service that actually started the McCarthy era in the United States and the allegations of communist subversion within the government.
We looked at the China lobby again in Radio Free America show number 11. We looked at part of its origin. We repeated that in Radio Free America number 14 about the World Anti-Communist League. In general, Radio Free America's 14 and 15 dealing with the World Anti-Communist League will flesh out your understanding of the China lobby.
All right, so I'll start that again. Meanwhile, in the United States, meanwhile 1948, KMT agents helped establish a powerful China lobby and collaborated with friends and U.S. agencies to target, and in some cases drive from government, old foes of the former U.S. KMT Tai Li alliance, including those inside the OSS. Okay, so the China lobby is getting together to drive the people opposed to the drug smugglers out of office. A scholarly book in 1960 noted that, quote, the narcotics business has been a factor in some activities and permutations of the China lobby, unquote, thus challenging the official Narcotics Bureau myth that KMT dope in this country was, quote, communist Chinese, unquote. So again, what we see in this case, not only the combining of the reactionary or the right wing or the extreme conservative factions in political circles with the intelligence, and in many cases the actual dope runners and warlords, to chase from government or slander people who are opposed to these kinds of policies. But on top of that, we see again that, as Adolf Hitler once put it, that impudent reversal of truth in which the pot calls the kettle black. And that is exactly what was going on with the China lobby and their allegations of communist Chinese dope flooding the American mainland.
We're going to be taking a musical break. Now, when we come back, we're going to look at an expansion or a further development of the cooperation between the dope-dealing Kuomintang and U.S. intelligence, and we're going to look at the role of the CIA and the Kuomintang in setting up the so-called Golden Triangle, which, after the poppy fields in Turkey began to decline due to pressure from some of the Western nations, the Golden Triangle became the primary heroin production area in the entire world for a long time, supplied the U.S. market. The rise of the Golden Triangle was inextricably linked with the Kuomintang and its support from the CIA, and we're going to look at that when we come back.
And we will be coming back, but first we're going to take a short break. Stick with us, get up, stretch a little bit, and we'll be back in a few minutes with more of Radio Free America right here on KFJC.
Radio Free America broadcast. Well, it's actually about the 24th Radio Free America, but it's the first broadcast specifically devoted to drugs and the American intelligence establishment. Although, as we have seen so far already, the American intelligence establishment includes large other factors in the American political establishment, including the military and other branches of the legislative and executive branches. And also, it includes many foreign intelligence branches, which we're going to be getting into as well. What we've just been talking about at some length is a particular foreign intelligence service, the notorious Kuomintang Intelligence Service under General Tai Lee. And as to put it in a nutshell, we've been talking about the fact that Tai Lee, in putting together his intelligence force for Chiang Kai-shek in China, co-opted the entire Green Gang, which was a gang of terrorists, kidnappers, thieves, and most specifically important for our purpose, drug dealers, and took it over and then linked his organization up with American intelligence.
Okay, now the cooperation between the CIA and Kuomintang elements, and recall that Kuomintang inextricably linked with dope-dealing syndicates, which it used as an anti-communist cadre in much the same way that the OSS and CIA used the Mafia and the Union Corps, the link-up between U.S. intelligence and the Kuomintang, inextricably involved in the dope traffic, as we're going to see now, this pattern has continued to operate, continued to operate historically, and was to result in the development of the so-called Golden Triangle area of Southeast Asia as a primary heroin or opium-growing center. The Golden Triangle generally refers to an area of Laos, Thailand, and Burma, which came to the forefront of the narcotics trafficking during the Vietnam War. And the traffic in Southeast Asia is what we're going to be looking at right now, and the CIA-Kuomintang cooperation in promoting it is front and center. Returning once again to the Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia by Alfred McCoy. While the work of French clandestine services in Indochina enabled the opium trade to survive a government repression campaign, some CIA activities in Burma helped transform the Shan states from a relatively minor poppy-cultivating area into the largest opium-growing region in the world. The precipitous collapse of the nationalist Chinese Kuomintang or KMT government in 1949 convinced the Truman administration that it had to stem, quote, the southward flow of communism, unquote, into Southeast Asia. In 1950, the Defense Department extended military aid to the French in Indochina. In that same year, the CIA began regrouping those remnants of the defeated Kuomintang army in the Burmese Shan states for a projected invasion of southern China. Although the Kuomintang army was to fail in its military operations, it succeeded in monopolizing and expanding the Shan state's opium trade. The Kuomintang shipped bountiful harvests to northern Thailand, where they were sold to General Phao Siriananda of the Thai police, a CIA client. The CIA had promoted the Phao-Kuomintang partnership in order to provide a secure rear area for the Kuomintang, but this alliance soon became a critical factor in the growth of Southeast Asia's narcotics traffic. With CIA support, the Kuomintang remained in Burma until 1961, when a Burmese army offensive drove them into Laos and Thailand. By this time, however, the Kuomintang had already used their control over the tribal populations to expand Shan State opium production by almost 1,000%, from less than 40 tons after World War II to an estimated 300 to 400 tons by 1962. From bases in northern Thailand, the Kuomintang have continued to send huge mule caravans into the Shan states to bring out the opium harvest. Today, over 20 years after the CIA first began supporting Kuomintang troops in the Golden Triangle region, these Kuomintang caravans control almost a third of the world's total illicit opium supply and have a growing share of Southeast Asia's thriving heroin business.
All right, continuing with the politics of heroin in Southeast Asia. Nationalist Chinese stragglers began crossing into Burma in late 1949, and in January 1950, remnants of the 93rd Division, 26th Army, and General Lee Mi's 8th Army arrived in Burma. 5,000 of General Lee Mi's troops who crossed into Indochina instead of Burma were quickly disarmed by the French and interned on Phu Quoc Island in the Gulf of Thailand until they were repatriated to Taiwan in June 1953.
By the way, this general we're talking about is L-I-M-I, not to be confused with Tai Lee, who we were talking about earlier.
Good point. However, the Burmese army was less successful than the French in dealing with the Chinese. By March 1950, some 1,500 KMT troops had crossed the border and were occupying territory between Kengtung City and Tachilek. In June, the Burmese army commander for King Tung State demanded that the KMT either surrender or leave Burma immediately. When General Lee Mi refused, the Burmese army launched a drive from King Tung City and captured Tachilek in a matter of weeks. 200 of Lee Mi's troops fled to Laos and were interned, but the remainder retreated to Mong Sat, about 40 miles west of Tachilek and 15 miles from the Thai border. Since the Burmese army had been tied down for 3 years in central Burma, battling four major rebellions, its King Tung contingent was too weak to pursue the KMT through the mountains to Mong Sat. But it seemed only a matter of months until the Burmese troops would become available for the final assault on the weakened KMT forces.